Great. Well, we've got lots of good questions already and more coming out, see. I'm going to, I'll take a, broadly speaking, give the questions a kind of more clarification early on and then more sort of application as we go through. So one of the first questions is about how you speak about a person or how you speak about yourself. The question is, if a person struggles with same-sex attraction, are they called, labelled gay, or is being called gay when you decide to actively live out homosexual acts and relationships?
I'm not sure who kind of has the official role of kind of laying down the rules on that. What I will say is that generally in our culture, when someone says they're gay, that tends to mean more than just this is a description of the kind of sexual feelings that they experience. It tends to mean this is who I am and this is what I'm about. And so for me as a Christian believer, it's certainly not appropriate for me to speak about sexual feelings as though they are who I am and what I'm about, which is why I'm not comfortable with using the language of being gay, because it sounds like that is defining of who I am. It sounds like that is an identity, and it isn't. The great thing about being a believer is not everything that describes you defines you. Lots of things describe us. Some of them are good things. We might be a husband or a wife. We might be tall. A lot of things that describe us are not good. We think of certain sins that we see within ourselves that other people might see within us. Oh, he's a very angry person, or she's a very gossipy person. None of those things, if we're belonging to Jesus, none of those things defines us. Sin still sadly describes us, but it doesn't define us. That's not who we are. Who we are is that we belong to Jesus. That's what defines us. That is what we're about. So I don't want to speak of any aspect of my experience or any of my sins in such a way that it implies this is who I am, because that's just not true.
Thank you. Thank you. You mentioned the passage in Matthew and sexual immorality and said that would include anything outside of marriage. How do you know that's the case? Someone asks, you know, it seems a lot to hang on that one word. How do you know that would discount sort of gay relationships?
Yep. Because Jesus is... His definition of what is sexual sin comes from the Old Testament. And the Old Testament is very clear that any sexual behavior outside of marriage is not right. That is reflected in the kind of Old Testament law. It's also reflected in the various narratives we have of total dysfunction from the lives of those who stray outside of that blueprint. So if Jesus was redefining what sexual morality meant from the Old Testament, he would have to be very, very explicit. And all Jesus does with the Old Testament sexual ethic is he doesn't revise it, he intensifies it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, yeah. Another question on clarification, a couple on this one. You talked about the fact that when we're raised, we'll be raised as the physical, with the physical bodies, genders we have now. So if you're male now, you'll be male in heaven. Could you just say a bit more about that? Is it not, when we talked about it would be like the angels, when Matthew talks about when Jesus talks about being like the angels, is that saying, would it be non-gender? What's that?
Yeah, this is a big question. So when Jesus says we'll be like the angels, he says that's within regard to something quite specific. He says we'll be like the angels in that we won't marry or be given in marriage. So in that regard, we will be like angels. But we know from the rest of the Bible, 1 Corinthians 15 especially, Philippians 3, that we will be raised with renewed physical bodies. So in that respect, we're not going to be like angels, because they are kind of spiritual, non-physical beings. We will be resurrected with physical bodies. And we know from Jesus' body that there is both continuity and difference between his pre-resurrection body and his post-resurrection body. He was still recognizably Jesus. He was still a male. And so when we are raised, we will still be recognizably us, whether we are men or women, but we will be us in a wonderfully transformed way that shows we are now the us that God always planned for us to be. So we're not going to be raised in the new creation as sexless beings. We will still be males and females, but the purpose of human sexuality will have been fulfilled in that we will now have Jesus fully face to face. We will have the reality of our marriage with him. We won't need the signpost anymore, so we won't have human marriage in heaven. So again, that shows us that human marriage, even at its finest, is temporal. It's not eternal. So you won't be married to your spouse in heaven. They will be your Christian brother or sister. They will be your great friend, but they will no longer be your spouse. So again, it's just a guard against kind of making marriage into more than it's meant to be. I remember one couple getting married once at my church and saying something slightly patronising to me about, oh, well, it's so nice that you have your friends, isn't it? And I remember saying, listen, my friendships are going to last longer than your marriage. Not because I thought their marriage wasn't going to last as long as they wanted it to, I hasten to add, but because friendship is eternal where marriage isn't. Marriage is a wonderful gift. It's a uniquely deep form of human intimacy. And the friendship that one would hope is driving the marriage and at the foundation of it, the friendship will continue, but the marital expression of that friendship will no longer be there.
Thank you. So I'm sitting back and look at the questions I go. So there's a number of questions about where does attraction, feelings, desires move into sin? At what point what's sinful? What's kind of, you know, not?
Yeah, so we know there's a difference in the Bible between temptation and sin. Jesus says in the Lord's Prayer, we're to pray, deliver us from temptation, forgive us for sin. So those are slightly different categories. We also know that in 1 Corinthians 10, I think it is, that we will be tempted, and yet God's will is for us to stand under that temptation without sinning. So temptation isn't sin. James 1 says that when we're tempted, we can't blame God, as if he's cooking up the temptation just to kind of test us. He says we're tempted when it's our own desires that are trying to trap us. So when I experience temptation, I need to come clean with the fact that actually the reason I'm being tempted is because I've got this kind of heart that can be tempted like that. So I need to, my temptation is an indication of my fallenness, but I'm to flee from temptation, to stand faithfully under temptation, and therefore the implication is you can be tempted without sinning. So temptation, the presence of temptation is not a sin. But in our case, it is a sign that we're a sinner, if that makes sense. So I think, again, we sometimes get this wrong because we think the distinction is between thought and deed. Jesus has already shown us in Matthew 5 that's not the case, because if you entertain the thought, you are committing the deed in your mind. So if you are fantasizing about sexual sin, you are committing a sexual sin. The distinction isn't between in here versus out there. The distinction, I think, is between the temptation coming at us and whether or not we entertain and offer hospitality to that temptation or not. Does that help?
Thank you. Yeah. So related to that, a question, so someone's asked about, if somebody realises that they are attracted to people of the same gender, then that would never find an appropriate sort of physical expression, whereas somebody who attracted somebody of the opposite gender potentially could.
Yep.
Does that mean you deal with those feelings differently, those attractions differently?
In some senses, yes, and in other senses, no. Someone who's unmarried and heterosexual and you're experiencing sexual feelings towards someone, those sexual feelings need to be fled from and resisted. So in that sense, the experience will be the same, whether it's someone you're attracted to of the same sex or of a different sex. The fact that one day you could get married to the person if they're of the opposite sex doesn't mean you entertain the sexual sin now as if well, it's just a timing issue, and it's not. It's a different act when you're unmarried to when you are married. It's not just that you got the timing wrong, it's a different act. And so, therefore, whatever sexual temptation we experience, all of us are to flee from sexual temptation. Paul says that in 1 Corinthians 6, he says it in Ephesians, is it 4 or Ephesians 5? Doesn't matter what species of sexual temptation it is, just get out of there, flee it. But on the other hand, it's obviously the case that if you are experiencing heterosexual attractions, there is the possibility that you will find a godly context in which some of those feelings can be expressed. That doesn't change your relationship to the temptation before then. It just means there may well be a time where it's appropriate for you to act on some of your sexual feelings. But even then, I've known too many married men who've been open with me about temptations. You still have to say no to a lot of sexual feelings.
Thank you. Great. So another question. Somebody writing saying they've got a Christian friend, but for whom the sort of issue of sex seems to be the all-consuming issue in their life. How would you advise a person to sort of counsel their friend?
Yeah, it depends what we mean by all-consuming. If it's becoming the kind of the fundamental non-negotiable, if I don't have this, I don't have life kind of thing, then that is idolatry. That's just what an idol is. It's something that is displacing God and our affections. But there's also a sense in which I want to kind of express compassion as well, because we're living in a culture that's just constantly hammering us with that very narrative. And so it's being trained within us to think that way. And the ways in which our culture encourages us to express those feelings are deeply destructive as well. So there are because of what God has designed sex to do, it is addictive. And so whether it's sexual fantasy, whether it's pornography, whether it's masturbation, there are going to be so many ungodly expressions of our sexuality that become deeply addictive and might actually become all-consuming, because we're now deep into very powerful addiction. So in other words, it's not enough just to say to someone, stop it. We need to help people on a number of different fronts. We need to show people not just what the Bible prohibits, but the Bible's rationale for that. We need to give someone something better to be turning to, rather than just asking them to turn from sin to nowhere else. And where there are patterns of addiction, if you look at pornography, studies have shown it changes your brain. Your brain kind of rewires itself in a very particular way because of this particular form of stimulation. So that's going to take some undoing. So if we're talking about that kind of it's all consuming, then people are going to need more than an occasional slap in the face with a couple of Bible verses. That they may well need some counselling and help. There may be a lot of other fronts on which they need to fight this. But if it's simply someone saying, well, you can't expect me to give my sexuality to Jesus, the answer is, hey, Jesus wants way more than your sexuality. So you're not thinking he's asking too much. You're thinking he's asking too little. He wants your heart and your whole life. And actually, your heart and your whole life need him. So that's no bad thing.
There's a number of questions about something you're talking about towards the end about friendship and those kind of issues. Some people saying, often in churches friendships can be quite superficial, so you might have some over a meal, but you wouldn't necessarily know much about their life. Or what could we be doing to kind of encourage people who are single, people who are living a celibate life, to actually feel part of the church in a wholehearted way? Quite a few questions around those kind of issues.
Yeah, some of it's going to be teaching, some of it's going to be church culture. Teaching-wise, we need to teach up how the New Testament thinks of church as being family. If you think through all the one another verses in the New Testament. I mean, it's so, there's like 25 of them or something, different one another's. We really need to dig into those and think, actually, what does it mean to be part of a church family where we belong to each other? So we need to redefine along biblical grounds what we think of church as being. If it's just that thing you come to every now and then to kind of doff your cap to God, that's not church. We need to teach up the importance of friendship and of healthy intimacy, but more than the teaching, we've just got to have the right culture. And if you have the right teaching but the wrong culture, the teaching's not going to land. And so the culture is more than just, come on guys, you've all got to play together and kind of get on. That's not going to do it. If we're wanting to foster a sense of family openness, intimacy, mutual trust, honesty, then actually we need to work hard at creating the kind of culture where you don't put on your best Christian face when you walk in the church buildings. And so many of our churches are still like that. And it's just poison. It just means we're really good at being hypocrites. So typically, church culture tends to be, I've got to look good so that Jesus looks good. The reality is, I need to be honest about my ongoing spiritual need so that Jesus looks sufficient. If we have churches where it's difficult to express spiritual neediness, we're in a really unhealthy church, and I don't care how sound the teaching is. That's just not a healthy church. There's good doctrine in hell. James says in James chapter 2, you say there's one God, good for you. The demons believe that. Doctrine is essential. It's vital and it is necessary. It is not on its own sufficient unless our church is a place, not just of gospel doctrine, but of gospel culture. Which means we should be giving the signal to one another every week that the reason we are here is because we just have a ridiculous amount of spiritual need for Jesus this week. And maturity in the Christian faith isn't that you end up needing Jesus less the further you go on in the Christian life. It's that you realize your need for Jesus only becomes more and more. But I fear too many of our churches are, the reason we're superficial, the reason we don't have deep community is there's not that sense of, we're just not being honest. What's the point? Stay in bed. I'm serious. So we need to find ways of fostering that sense of, and part of it's the tone from the front, part of it's the teaching, part of it's the mentality all of us come with, but we want this to be a place of spiritual reality, which means we can't just keep, let's just ban the word fine to start with. We need to pray for that and to try to begin to foster that sense of openness. Not that we tell everyone all the worst and most ridiculous things about ourselves. I'm not calling for that. I'm just saying that we give up any pretense that we're more spiritually capable than we actually are.
Lots of different types of questions. I'm going to do some different types of questions to try and make sure we get a bit of a spread. One person asks, any tips on how to teach children about this topic? E.g., a friend of this person has a friend, a little a three-year-old has a friend with two dads. How do you start to approach those kind of issues?
Yeah, it's great to. I think it's really important to. I think two obvious ways not to do it. One, we don't want to say nothing to our kids, because then again, they're just going to be picking up signals only from the culture around them. But we don't want to teach it in such a way that turns our children into little Pharisees. So we don't want to teach, hey, there's the big bad world out there, but we're the good guys in here. Because as they grow up, they're going to become far more acquainted with your sin than anyone else's. And if they've been raised on we're good, they're bad, they just need to meet some really delightful non-Christians, of whom there are plenty, and they just need to get to see some of the less palatable aspects of your sinful nature, and the whole premise of their Christianity is going to be threatened. So I know kids who've come from Christian homes where actually they've been taught a form of self-righteousness, and two things have happened. They've met a delightful gay couple, and their parents have divorced. So as far as they're concerned, well, mum and dad are just full of it. But these guys are genuinely nice. So if Christianity is, we're Christians because we're better, then actually I think these guys are going to be further, they must be more, you know, further with God than my own parents were. So what that means, I think, is that we do want to teach children what God says is for our best, but we want to teach that in a way that shows that all of us have fallen short of that. So we want to teach our kids, actually, God says we're designed to have a mum and a dad. But actually, and God says this is, you know, depending on the age of the kid, whether you want to bring the sex dimension into it or not is another matter. But you just want to show, actually, these are the things God says are best for us. And yet, actually, even us as your parents, we don't always get this right. You know, we keep looking to God for help and for forgiveness. But we know that this is what he says and this is why he says it. And so this is what we're trying to press into and to head towards. That's teaching them both Christian ethics. It's teaching them the goodness of God, not just a set of arbitrary rules that we're obligated to follow. And it's also teaching them grace, because it's saying, listen, we're not pretending we've got all this figured out and sewn up and we're perfect at it. We're not. Which then means the child now, when they become aware of how they fall short of it, are going to have a category of, well, I know there's grace for me because there was grace for mum and dad. Whereas if what we're teaching our kids is Christian performance, they're either going to feel self-righteous because they meet the standards, or they're going to feel crushed because they don't. So we've got to teach grace and not law.
Thank you. Quite a lot of things. How should you respond if a non-Christian invites you to their gay wedding?
That's a great question. And please be the kind of Christian that a non-Christian wants at their gay wedding. So if you get invited, good on you. If you never get invited, are you being the kind of friend of gay people that Jesus would be? Worth asking that question, isn't it? So that affirms the dilemma. It doesn't answer the question. It really does depend on the friendship and the kinds of interactions you've had with them before and the sort of dynamic you've got. There's no one size fits all answer to this. What I would say is there are good reasons to go and there are good reasons to not go. There are also bad reasons to go and bad reasons to not go. A good reason to go might be that actually, well, this person knows exactly where I stand. My presence is not going to be misunderstood as being complete affirmation of all of this, but it's good for them to know that I'm physically with them, even if I'm not approving of what is going on. And I feel like I can attend in a way that affirms the relationship between us without endorsing the lifestyle that they are about to enter into. A good reason to not go is because you're thinking, I just don't see how this is going to be interpreted as anything other than you are ultimately on board with this. And obviously, if your conscience is saying, I just don't think I can be there for this, then you mustn't go. A bad reason to go is just that you're you're conflict averse and it just feels like the easier option. A bad reason to not go is because you think, well, this is just disgusting and yucky, and you know, I don't want to go anywhere near that kind of yucky sin. As if you're not yourself a yucky sinner. So I've seen Christians handle this in different ways. Sometimes they've been acting, I think, out of an ungodly attitude, and sometimes they've been acting out of a godly attitude. But we need to, whatever we do, we need to do it in a way that honours both the truth that we believe and also at the very same time honours what this person means to us. Both of those things need to be honoured by the same decision. You can't play them off against each other. So if you're feeling like it's right for you to not go, you need to find a way of not going that affirms how deeply you care about this person and how much they mean to you. And if you do go, you need to go in such a way that shows that you are for this person in such a way that is, you are so for them that you're not going to always agree with them precisely because you do love them.
Great. Next question. What happens if a gay couple who have already adopted children come to church and one of the parents becomes a Christian? What should church or pastor advise, teach?
Yes, it's great. This happens tons, by the way. This is awesome. It's a great problem to have. Increasingly, given the kind of culture we're in, as people come to Christ, they're coming to Christ with all kinds of very messy relational baggage. That's just normal now. And so the question for any new disciple is always, that's you, not me apparently, the demons in the microphone coming out. The question is always then, what is this existing relational baggage, what is the best biblical footing to put it on? And we know that if a couple are in a romantic and sexual relationship that the Bible says they shouldn't be, then actually part of their discipleship is going to be that they have to learn now to express their relationship in a godly way. And it might mean transferring it from the kind of romantic category to the friendship category. They may feel that it's not going to work for both of them to live under the same roof, if that's the case. And so what I have seen happen in one case I can think of, it was a lesbian couple, actually both of them came to faith, and one of them said, you know what, I don't think I should live in the same house anymore. And someone from church said, I live just around the corner, come live with me. That way you're super close, you can be there anytime you want, but you're not kind of the couple that you once were. So that kind of thing may be significant as well. It does get messy, but if the church is being church, again, people shouldn't be saying, well, now that I'm a Christian, I've got less family because the church tore it up. They should be saying, my family has been reconfigured and it's now way bigger than it was beforehand.
Great. A member of my family is gay. How do I explain this to my children? I want to be open and honest.
Good to be open and honest with kids. We want to be able to explain these things to our kids, ideally before they first come across how the world's going to explain it to them. I think we want to be on the front foot on this one, and giving them that kind of initial framework. So I don't think it's helpful to not have those conversations, but we need to have those conversations in a way that's spiritually healthy and not spiritually unhealthy. And sometimes I've seen Christians approach this kind of issue and the kind of language is, this is what is right and this is what we believe and what we do. This is what is wrong and that's what those people out there do. And what that basically communicates to the child is, we are better than those people are. And then one of two things happens. The child, as the child is growing up, meets some absolutely delightful gay people. and also becomes more and more aware of the depth of their parents' own sin. And I've seen this happen a couple of times, actually, where a child's got to know some lovely gay people and at the same time their own parents have divorced. So they're thinking, well, hey, if this is all about niceness, if that's how we measure spirituality, then actually these guys have got way more spirituality than you have. So we need to try and teach what is God's best to our kids in a way that shows, again, God's rules are not arbitrary and cruel, but expressions of his goodness. But also in a way that shows none of us has lived up to this perfectly. And even us, your parents, we've got this wrong so many times. Which is why we love the fact that God is so forgiving of us. We want to live his way. There are going to be times, even in the future, where we get this wrong. And there are going to be things we're going to need to say sorry to God for. There are going to be things we're going to need to say sorry to you for as well. And then the child is learning, okay, this is a grace issue, not a law issue. And therefore, when the child begins to become aware of their own sexual fallenness, they're not left thinking, this must mean I can't be a Christian, in which case, why bother trying? They're actually thinking, oh, no, this is exactly what my parents told me about. This is normal and nothing to freak out about. I don't need to worry about this because I know this is an issue where all of us find the grace of God and need it. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Carry on the theme of children. What can I do to prevent the possibility of my children making a decision to change their gender identity in the future?
Again, I think what we teach children at a young age can be a really helpful foundation for what they then come across in later life. So we don't want... And this is true, actually, of all of us. One of the big mistakes I think we've made is in talking about what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, I think we've often traded in quite unbiblical stereotypes. Our culture has its own set of unbiblical stereotypes, and I think the church often has its own version of those same stereotypes. And so the guys' events at church are about sports and curry and alcohol, because that's what guys do. The women's events are about craft and coffee and learning how to make a Christmas wreath. Because if you open the Bible, that's what it says in the book of On Making This Club. Now, those things are often generally true, but none of them are biblical. None of those are biblical categories for what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. Yet we often kind of imply that this is what it is to be a guy and that's what it is to be a girl. And therefore, anyone who doesn't feel like they fit is wrestling with gender identity questions that they probably don't need to be wrestling with. So I think the Bible gives us a much broader range of what it looks like to be a spiritual man or a spiritual woman. So think about David in the Old Testament. The first time we meet David in 1 Samuel, he's literally, in the Hebrew, he's described as a pretty boy. We're told he's attractive, but the word for attractive is a Hebrew word for beautiful that's only ever used elsewhere of women. So pretty boy would be our way of describing that. He's someone who spends an inordinate amount of time playing a harp and writing poems about his feelings. Called Psalms, right? Now, if that kid's in your church, you're thinking, whoa, I think we've got some gender identity confusion issues. Let's get him in a rugby uniform as quickly as possible and get him outside and he needs some more fresh air or something. Similarly, there are some women in the Old Testament who are very feisty. Think of Deborah. And that raises the broader issues of, well, what does it mean to be a biblical man and what does it mean to be a biblical woman? Those are very, very good questions to ask, and we just need to be very, very careful that we don't go a millimetre further than the Bible does in answering them. Often the Bible gives us principles. We then try and apply those principles and then mistake our application for God's word. Which is exactly what the Pharisees did with the law. They mistook their application of the law with the law itself. So unless you did what they were doing, you were breaking God's law. And Jesus often had to give them a good kicking for that way of thinking. So we want to say as much as the Bible says, not less than the Bible says and not more than the Bible says. I think I'll pause at that point.
Yeah, good, very helpful. What makes a person change, feel, want to be the other gender he or she is born with?
That can be any number of things, and that's why it is so vital for us to really listen to people who are going through these experiences of feeling like they are in the wrong type of body. Sometimes it is as simple as, I've never felt like I fit in with the model of maleness or femaleness that I've been presented with. Sometimes it's driven more by that. Sometimes it's a deeper thing than that, and it's a sense of, I've never felt at home in this flesh. And I've always felt like I'd be more at home in that kind of flesh. So that can often be what lies behind it. It is almost always extraordinarily painful. So whatever we might think as Christians about some of the thinking going on behind these discussions in our culture, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that the pain is very, very real. And actually, as Christians, we can account for it because our own theology tells us that creation has been subjected to frustration. That includes our bodies. And so we don't have a straightforward relationship with our bodies. However, we don't then want to immediately leap into thinking, well, the answer to that, therefore, is clearly to alter your body, and that will be what makes you feel authentically you, because we know the issue ultimately is deeper than just what our bodies look like and feel like. So I think we should be places of unusual compassion and patience on these issues, but we want to steer people to where the ultimate hope lies, and that's not in what we can do with our bodies now, but with what Jesus did with his body 2,000 years ago. Because by his wounds we will be healed. And it may not be healing that we can fully experience in this life, but it will be healing one day.
Great. This one's interesting question. I think it's addressed to you personally, but feel free to answer it generally. Do you think your sexual feelings can change? Is that something you think people who struggle with same-sex attraction should hope for?
They can. I've met, obviously, most of my pastoral conversations have been with men rather than women, but I've so many men have shared with me that they went through a period of same-sex attraction either around puberty or in teenage years or even at university, sometimes for a few weeks, sometimes for a few months, sometimes for even a few years. And yet the feelings kind of seem to come of their own accord and then seem to leave of their own accord. So sometimes our sexual feelings change just as you know, sometimes they're just not settled yet. And they kind of change naturally, if you like. I know other people where God seems to have changed their sexual feelings almost, well, I guess miraculously. I'm always slightly anxious if Christians become fixated on that, simply because, well, I had someone come up to me once at a talk and say, I promise I can deliver you of same-sex attraction. So would you like me to? So I said, can I ask you a few questions first? I said, can you deliver yourself of your own temptations? Do you think your temptations also need to be delivered? You need to be delivered from them? And he said, no. So I said, can you show me from the Bible on what basis you differentiate between your temptations and my temptations? Why mine need deliverance but yours don't? Next question, if you deliver me of these temptations, so that I only experience heterosexual feelings from now on, can you guarantee I will never experience sexual temptation again? Mm. And he said, no. And I said, well, what will I have gained? You know, going from, well, I'm struggling with this form of temptation, now I'm struggling with that form of temptation, doesn't feel like a net increase in holiness to me. I've just transferred the theatre of warfare from one to another. And at the moment, I kind of vaguely know what I'm doing with this kind of temptation. I've got a few years under the belt of fighting it. I'm not sure it's going to help me to suddenly switch that out for a different form of sexual temptation. But the broader issue is this. I don't know what your Bible says, but in my Bible, heterosexuality is not part of the fruit of the Spirit. The opposite of homosexuality isn't heterosexuality, it's holiness. Just as the opposite of broken heterosexuality isn't broken homosexuality, it's holiness. So the change that I most want, and the change that actually the Bible does promise, is that we get to become more like Jesus. And one of the means God might use to help us become more like Jesus is having to continue to wrestle with certain forms of temptation by which God teaches you the sufficiency of his grace and of your ongoing need for him. So that's what I'm rooting for. I don't care really what forms of temptation I experience. I do care that I grow in a love for Christ, and I want to grow in a hatred for sin. I want to be better at mortifying it, of killing it off, and of standing faithfully under temptation. That really matters.
Great. You've helpfully talked about sex is not everything in marriage. So is it okay to marry if you have same-sex interests? Attraction.
Did I say? Yeah, I don't know if I said sex isn't everything in marriage, although it probably isn't. So let's pretend I did say. So if the question is, can I marry someone that I might never have sex with? I don't think so, because Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 that when you're married, your body now belongs to your spouse, and you are there to fulfil their conjugal rights. I think is the language in my translation. So I think to intentionally enter a marriage in which you're thinking, I'm going into this, but I'm not prepared or willing to have sex, is actually, you shouldn't be going into marriage then. However, I do know a number of guys who are same-sex attracted who have met some of the other sex where there's been sufficient attraction and chemistry in order to be married. So I can think of one guy who has shared his story publicly, so I can refer to him without breaking any confidence. He's called Sean. He's married to Gabby. And Sean had always been same-sex attracted. He met Gabby, and the two of them just really hit it off unusually. He was always open with her about his sexuality, and that's key on this whole thing. And they both felt, actually, it feels like it makes sense for us to start dating, and then they felt it made sense to get married. And I remember Sean telling his story once and saying, it turns out I didn't need to be attracted to women. I just needed to be attracted to Gabby. That makes sense to me, because I don't think there's a verse in the Bible that says you should be generally attracted to the other sex. There's lots of verses saying you should be faithful to your spouse, and you know, more than that in verses, places like Proverbs and Song of Songs, you should delight in your spouse's sexuality. The Bible is much less embarrassed than we are about talking quite graphically about all that kind of stuff. And if you're not married, you should be chaste and abstinent. So, yes, it's possible for same-sex attracted people to get married. Mm.
Similar lines, how does the Bible view a romantic relationship, romantic love between two same-sex people outside of marriage?
Outside of marriage, well, obviously, we know that the Bible says that sex is prohibited between people of the same sex. whether they are legally married in this country or not. If someone is saying, what about a non-sexual but still romantic same-sex relationship? And I think that is profoundly unwise. And the reason for that is because in the Bible, friendship and marriage are two different types of relationship. It's not that marriage is a kind of extreme form of friendship. You just kind of increase the intensity and then it becomes marriage. The two are quite differently shaped ways of relating. Marriage, by necessity, has to be exclusive. It's based on an exclusive covenant. And so if you're married, you do not have, you should not have, sexual and romantic interests outside of the marriage. That is harming the marriage if you do. Friendship is built very differently. Friendship does not require exclusivity. And so if you and I are kind of like best buds, and then I get to know him and he becomes a really good friend as well, so good a friend I don't even know his name. It's not a zero-sum game where the deeper, the more friendship I have with him, the less I have with you. Friendship doesn't work like that. Friendship actually can grow when you fold more people into it. C.S. Lewis observed this beautifully, that actually there was him and Tolkien and a guy called, I think, Charlie Williams, who were really tight as friends, the three of them. Williams then died, and Lewis was thinking, well, A, he was gutted about that, but B, he was thinking, I guess the upside of this is I'll get more of Tolkien now. And what he discovered was he ended up getting less of Tolkien because there was a whole side of Tolkien that Charles brought out that Lewis couldn't. And that's how friendship works. It's not a zero-sum game. It's quite beautiful. So the moment you take friendship and you say, let's make this friendship exclusive and romantic, you're actually saying it's no longer friendship. You're saying it's quasi-marital. Which means I just think that's a very unstable compound. You either end up going full marital, full sexual, or you have to ditch the romantic and exclusive component and be friends. I just don't think it works to try to... Those two things don't fit together.
A couple of questions about homosexuality in particular. So of all the sins, why has homosexuality historically been identified as the most taboo?
Short, flippant, but true answer, because we're idiots. We know that part of the work of the Spirit is to convict the world of sin. We are often very, very good at being convicted of other people's sins. And so when it's a sin that most of us don't personally experience, it's very easy to make that the kind of sin that we always use as our examples of how awful the world is, or something like that. So I think a lot of it is it's just to do with the fact that we're always far more sensitive to the sins that we're not personally experiencing temptation towards ourselves. And I think we just don't reflect the balance and proportion of Scripture. So virtually every reference to homosexuality in the New Testament comes in the context of lists of sins that include gluttony and greed and lying and all kinds of other things.
Someone has a question about, you're talking a lot about the good news you want to present to people. They ask, is there ever a place for the church to make an apology on behalf of the fact that perhaps they've not, the Church of Jim has not welcomed people as they should have done, or they've been judgmental or frosty, that they perhaps have contributed to some of these mental health issues? What would you say to that?
I'd say probably yes, but with lots of caveats. So it's too easy to do this in a kind of giant virtue signalling kind of way that just looks like it's a strategy rather than heartfelt. And people don't want to be handled, people don't want to be a project, and sometimes these things can look like we're treating the gay community as a project. I think in conversations, I did a Q&A once with a secular student LGBT group, and I didn't give an apology on behalf of all Christians everywhere because I don't represent all Christians everywhere and they haven't given me that authority, and not all Christians everywhere owe an apology. But I did say, listen, there are parts of the church that haven't always honoured gay people in the way that we should have done, as people who are precious in God's sight, made in his image, worthy of our care and service and interest. So I felt it right to say, there are some, you know, let's just be honest about that. There are times when we've got this wrong. And if you've been demeaned by a Christian believer, then I am sorry about that. I'm not taking responsibility for what they've done, but I do want to own the fact that we're both part of the same spiritual body. So I do need to address it. So I think in that kind of context, it's not always inappropriate. I think in a relational context, I can think of a couple who came up to me once at church and said, I think the Lord has convicted us that we pushed a gay friend out of our life because we didn't approve of them, whereas actually we should have been drawing close to them and including them in our lives, and we've realised that we've got that wrong. Do you think we should apologise to them? And I said, yeah. So they did, and they said to this friend of theirs, we've realised now that actually we responded in a really unchristian way. And actually it was enough to rekindle the friendship. The friend started coming with them to church. At no point were they affirming anything they shouldn't. The guy always knew where they stood. But I thought that was an appropriate context to apologise. They had something they needed to apologise for from their own kind of past conduct.
Related to the kind of coming to church issues again, how can the church, churches be attracting people in from the LGBT community? And when people do come, how do you then treat people? The couple together come in, how do you deal with that? What's right, what's wrong? How do you sort of accept those people, not affirm the actions, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm tempted to say the answer to both questions is don't treat LGBT people as if they're a different species of humanity. How do we attract anyone into church? I think by being a place where people just get a sense anyone is welcome, no question is off limits, that it's okay to be here and to be a skeptic or even to be an opponent of the Christian faith. We would just love to have you anyway. And where we're going to take you as you seriously, whoever you are, whatever your story is, whatever it is you're into, whatever it is you're about, we're going to take you seriously. So I think if that's our posture generally, we will be attractive, and it won't really matter that there won't be any demographic that won't feel attracted to that. I think authentic, visible, deep community, as our culture becomes more, you know, loneliness is becoming, it's becoming a cause of death in our culture now. Again, that is going to be something that makes the church stand out, if we really are being that kind of family together. People are going to be saying, well, I still think what those guys believe is a bit crazy, but people really are cared for and looked after in that group of people. Whatever it is they believe, it's doing something good to them. What do you do when a gay couple walks through the door is what do you do when a human being walks through the door? You welcome them, you're glad to see them, you give them a bulletin or whatever, and you show them a seat. One of the most discouraging things that ever happened to me in my own church was when one of our people who does the kind of initial greeting to people as they step in came up to me in a panic and said, Sam, I think a gay couple's here. I was like, you distract them, I'll call the police. And I was like, she said, what do I do? What do I do? I was like, what do you mean, what do you do? What do you normally do when a human being comes in the church building? You smile, you greet them, you welcome them. What the heck is wrong with us that we're kind of like, oh my goodness, it's, you know, we've so extracted the issue of homosexuality out of a gospel framework that we've totally thrown ourselves and don't know what to do with it. We just need to put it back in the gospel framework and say, hey, all of us are sinners. All of us are sexual sinners. So what do we do when any of us walks into a church building? We offer a welcome. We're glad to see people. We want them to come. We're not going to affirm everybody who walks through the door and everything that they're about and everything they're into, but we want them to come.
There's still loads of questions, and we're not going to have time for more than a couple more. But there's a couple of questions about if somebody is same-sex attracted, if that's her expression, what would be appropriate and inappropriate in terms of the sort of relationships that they could go into? Would it be appropriate to marry, to have someone of the opposite gender? Or is it appropriate for them to have a non-sexual relationship, living together in a house with somebody of the same sex? What would you counsel on that?
Yeah, I think there are very clear things the Bible prohibits, and there's a lot of freedom outside of those prohibitions. So I know a number of Christians who would still say they're predominantly same-sex attracted, but who've been able to marry someone of the other sex. That person has been the kind of exception to the rule. I would never counsel doing that if the other person doesn't know that you've wrestled with same-sex attraction. That's not a fun thing to spring on someone on your wedding night. So the people I know who have got married, it's always been to someone they've been open with about these issues. So they're both going into it with their eyes open and with a council of people who know them well. That can be a great thing. Obviously, we're designed for healthy intimacy, so we want people who are same-sex attracted to have real and deep friendships. It's perfectly right, fine for someone to live with someone else as a friend. That I even think can be a very healthy thing to do. Where it becomes unhealthy is where that person is more than just a friend. And even if you're saying we're going to be non-physical and non-sexual, I've had a number of people say, what if I have a romantic but non-sexual friendship? And it sounds like the worst of both worlds, to be honest. It's marriage without benefits rather than friendship with benefits. Marriage, and it's not that there's a kind of continuum where you've got friendship, and then as friendship intensifies, it becomes something, there's marriage over here, and there's a kind of gradual intensification from here to here. The fact is, these are two different types of relating to someone. Marriage, in order to be healthy, has to be exclusive. It's part of the architecture of marriage that it is a zero-sum game. If you are showing romantic and sexual intimacy to someone who isn't your spouse, you are taking something away from your spouse. It has to be exclusive. The architecture of friendship is such that it doesn't have to be exclusive. Every friendship will be unique because every combination of people is unique. But if I'm really good friends, really, really good friends with you, and then become really, really good friends with him, you're not losing out on that. That's not a zero-sum game. In fact, if you bring someone else into the friendship, as C.S. Lewis so beautifully observed, you end up being able to draw more out of each other than would have been the case if it was just the two of you. And so I think the moment you start to take friendship and say, well, let's make this an exclusive thing, you're actually taking it out of the category of normal friendship and you're beginning to put it in the category of quasi-marital friendship. But you're trying to do that in a way with someone you can't be married to, and it's not right to give romantic and sexual expression to it. And I just think that's a very, very unstable compound. Either you will end up becoming regular friends without the exclusivity, or you'll end up becoming quasi-married in a way that's disobedient.
Thank you. We'll do one more question, then we really must stop. I'm sorry, there's still some more questions I hadn't meant to get to. There's so many. Somebody asked us, to what extent might a Christian expect a change in their feelings? If somebody was predominantly same-sex attracted, was that something that could be changed or not? Was it an expectation of change? How would you address those kind of issues?
Yes, that's a really significant question. And I think that the short answer is, I don't think the Bible promises that temptation will be removed as you grow in Christ. God promises that we will be given the means to stand under temptation. He doesn't promise that actually, hey, a sign that you're more Christian is that you just don't experience any temptations anymore. That I don't think is in the Bible. Sexual feelings can change. Sometimes just as the body develops, sexual feelings can change. God is always obviously sovereign, so if he wants to change the general pattern of your sexual feelings, he's very able to do that. But I think that the change that God does promise in our feelings is that we will just grow to love Christ more and more. We will long for holiness more and more, and we will increase in our hatred for sin. That doesn't mean temptation will disappear, but it hopefully means that we're fighting it with an ever-growing resolve and understanding. And it's, you know, the opposite of homosexuality isn't heterosexuality, it's holiness. And that's what all of us should want. If someone flicked a switch and I suddenly went from being same-sex attracted to opposite-sex attracted, I'd still deal with temptation. There wouldn't necessarily be a net increase in holiness. Heterosexuality is not listed as being part of the fruit of the Spirit. But self-control is, and godliness is. And so that's the change I'm most looking for, is to become more like Jesus. And that I'm more hating sin and mortifying sin and fleeing from temptation. I don't care massively what form of temptation it is I'm fleeing from. I care more that I'm fleeing from it and growing in my capacity to do that.